We are back in front of the Booker T. Washington tree, here to see the nail. Do you see it, Bonnie?
No. There's a nail.
So if you get up close enough and look up, you can see this one kind of rusty nail just sticking out of the tree. She can't even take a picture of it. It held the sign that originally said Booker T. Washington tree. It's October 24th, 2008. We've been dispatched on the historic trail of the Buffalo Soldiers. We're going to travel from the Presidio of San Francisco to Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks. My name is Justine Lai, and I'm a park ranger for the National Park Service.
And I'm Bonnie Swift, Deputy Director of the Stanford Storytelling Project. We were sent on this mission as part of our jobs. We were dispatched to uncover the forgotten story of the Buffalo Soldiers in the California parks. Little do most people know that before there was a park service, the Army guarded our first national parks. Our first rangers were actually soldiers.
I'd already covered much of our itinerary as part of my job at the park service. Honestly, I expected to see exactly what I had already seen before. Fruit stands, gas stations, the occasional historic plaque. Except this time Bonnie would be there, so it would be more fun. But it would take longer.
The trip would take longer because we'd be taking the historic Buffalo Soldier route instead of the faster freeways. It was the perfect time of year for a more leisurely road trip, especially to the Sierra Nevada. We loaded up my little white pickup truck and headed south, bound first for Yosemite.
But along the way, the road took some curious turns. We didn't at all find what we expected. History and that California landscape both revealed themselves in unexpected ways. It turns out that when you see California through the lens of history, you see a lot more than first meets the eye. The Presidio of San Francisco has been a military post since, I think, 1776. At first by the Spanish, then by the Mexico, and then by the U.S.
So, we're just leaving San Francisco, and now we're going to hit the road.
After the Civil War, African Americans were allowed to enlist in the Army for the first time. Congress established 4 all-black regiments. Legend has it that the Native Americans gave them the name we often use now. They called them Buffalo Soldiers, because their hair was like a buffalo's woolly coat. In Native American culture, the buffalo is a powerful symbol, so the nickname Buffalo Soldier was a respectful one.
If you've heard of the Buffalo Soldiers, it's probably because you've heard the Bob Marley song, which has to do with the Buffalo Soldiers who fought in the Indian Wars. The Indian Wars were in the late 19th century, when the United States conquered the frontier. The Buffalo Soldiers fought the natives, pursued bandits, built roads, scouted, and mapped. In 1898, the Spanish-American War broke out, so Buffalo Soldiers next went to Cuba. They fought alongside Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders in the Battle of San Juan Hill, the bloodiest and most famous battle of the Spanish-American War. Roosevelt and the Rough Riders became famous afterwards. The Buffalo Soldiers did not.
But they continued to serve as segregated regiments. When an insurrection started up in the Philippines, the Buffalo Soldiers went there. When they came back in 1902, they came through San Francisco and were given a new peacetime assignment. It was garrison duty at the Presidio and guard duty at the newly created national parks. And this is the chapter that most people don't know about.
The Army protected the parks every summer from 1891 to 1913. And for 3 of those years, 1899, 1903, and 1904, they were Buffalo Soldiers. The soldiers on duty in the parks were literal trailblazers. They made maps and put out wildfires. But they weren't just dealing with nature. They were also monitoring the settlers. Back then, the government had set aside these huge tracts of land for preservation, but there was no actual law to protect them. The unknown chapter is a story of transformation. The Buffalo Soldiers went from being warriors on the frontier to stewards of our first parks.
When the army units patrolled the national park, they were not only protecting the land, but protecting the very idea that it held the park.
Because a new concept has to be defended.
Right, otherwise people are like, hey, why are you saving all this land? There'll be gold in them hills. Or, you know, oh, look at those giant trees. Wow, I happen to be a logger.
The Buffalo Soldiers left San Francisco in May and headed south on El Camino Real. At Gilroy, they turned east, went over Pacheco Pass to Madera. At Madera, the troops split. Those headed for Yosemite went northeast to Wawona. And the troops headed for Sequoia went down the San Joaquin Valley, through Fresno, and over to Three Rivers.
On their trip, they covered about 20 miles each day. There would be 100 soldiers on horseback, followed by mule trains and wagons. They headed down the dusty El Camino Real south to Gilroy. El Camino Real is Spanish for the Royal Road, or the King's Highway. It runs north to south, connecting California's 21 missions from Sonoma down to San Diego. Construction on El Camino Real started 325 years ago in 1683, while Europe was in the midst of a renaissance and California was becoming an appendage of the Spanish Empire. Spain is long gone from California, but the missions are still around, and so are portions of El Camino Real. It's no longer the main route. At first, we had a hard time finding it.
We're looking for El Camino, because apparently the Buffalo Soldiers took El Camino Real all the way south to Gilroy, right?
Yeah, south to Gilroy.
South to Gilroy. And El Camino still exists, and we're going to find it eventually, but we're in a maze of freeways, and we can't find it anywhere.
Horse roads turn into wagon roads, turn into streets, turn into freeways.
As we drove down El Camino, I noticed all the new construction and thought about all the changes taking place. Normally, driving down the road, you don't think too much about how things used to be. But when you're following someone's footsteps, knowing that they were in the exact same place about 100 years ago, you can't help but wonder what this place must have been like when they passed through.
Things have certainly changed, especially just south of San Francisco.
We're looking for a Walgreens. The site of the Walgreens is the first soldiers' encampment site. They stopped in San Bruno, and they stopped at a place called Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Walgreens!
Where?
Right there.
Where?
Right.
Where?
Right here.
No way. Oh, here it is! We are at Walgreens. Uncle Tom's Cabin was also a business known as, I believe, 14 Mile House. All these places back then just called themselves based on their distance from the nearest major city.
Driving south on El Camino, we passed through a long stretch of strip malls. Old hotels with faded neon signs, adult video shops, TV repair stores, Goodwills, Starbucks, Chinese takeout. What used to be a series of distinct townships has now become a sprawling suburban landscape.
Waded out past the wave swells. Where we all
so there's an article from the San Francisco Call, February 19th, 1900, that doesn't describe the army going to Uncle Tom's Cabin, but a member of the San Mateo County Hunt. Okay, so well, the headline is Ride Over San Bruno Foothills.
A wide detour was made into the foothills towards the ocean. The hounds and their field were visible for nearly an hour to spectators. This was due to the open nature of the country.
That's the funny thing about this stretch of the, I guess, the Santa Clara Valley, is that it's all one big sprawling mass, whereas before it was separate distinctive stops, like pass by nothing, then all of a sudden here's the roadhouse, mm-hmm. You know?
Now it's just a Walgreens.
Something kind of sad about that.
He said someday the moon will reach out to the sun.
This isn't to say that all is lost. There are still signs of times past. Somehow, if something looked or felt historic, our mood would suddenly lift.
After most of the afternoon poking along the old wagon road, we arrived in San Jose. This is the first place where we had real evidence, a newspaper article that documented the time when the Buffalo Soldiers came through. They likely camped at the old fairgrounds, known as Agricultural Park.
It was the site of San Jose's racetrack. It also had a velodrome, which is where bicycle races took place.
Right here?
In this general area.
And now there's a Pizza Hut.
Yeah, we're parked next to a Pizza Hut. I'm going to read some newspaper articles that relate to the Army being in San Jose on their way to the parks. And the first is from the San Jose Evening News of May 22, 1903. So 1903, this was the year the Buffalo Soldiers of the 9th Cavalry were on their way to Yosemite and Sequoia. Here it goes. Colored troopers in San Jose. Troop M, 9th U.S. Cavalry, passed through this city this morning en route for the Yosemite Valley, where they will be stationed for this summer on patrol duty. The troop is made up of colored soldiers in command of white officers. The company was mounted on spirited horses and made a soldierly appearance.
These are the sort of accounts we have of the Buffalo Soldiers when they were on the road. The briefest of brief mentions in the newspaper. There's no real record of what they were like as individuals, no letters, diaries, or photographs, and the Army records are notoriously sparse with words. We began to wonder, how could we recover a history that was never documented in the first place?
But we did know something about one Buffalo soldier, Charles Young. Over the course of our journey, I really came to appreciate him. Charles Young was the son of former slaves in Kentucky, and the third African-American to graduate from West Point.
Even though the units were entirely African-American, more often than not, the officers were white. The big exception to this, of course, is Charles Young of the 9th Cavalry. And so when he led troops in 1903, specifically to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, he was the acting superintendent, so the first African-American superintendent of the park.
Purple clouds turn scarlet in the setting sun, where sagebrush turns to live oak and the whitetail run. The air is cool as music when the day's done.
Slowly we made our way through the last of the big boxes and straight roads and into the countryside. And slowly, a feeling of incredible relief settled in as we meandered into the hills. We arrived just before dark at our first camping spot.
The Buffalo Soldiers stopped for the night in the same place, sort of. At the time, it was the San Luis Ranch. Now San Luis Ranch is underwater, flooded by what is now the San Luis Reservoir. That afternoon, we drove on Highway 152, which goes east, through the dry, grassy hills over Pacheco Pass. The Buffalo Soldiers passed through this area on horseback. They probably enjoyed a more leisurely pace.
We missed a stop on the way.
But it wasn't our fault.
It was called the
Bell Station Restaurant. At the time, it was a hotel. It was the place to stop in Pacheco Pass.
But it was on the other side of the freeway, and this freeway is more just like a narrow country road where everybody's going really fast. And there was no way that we could really turn into it.
Everyone's got somewhere to go. We're all in cars. We're going 65 miles an hour. Plus, there are enormous big rigs.
So we had to go past.
All day up the sand walking. Turn west again. Up through Pacheco.
I think I remember this one specific moment where we were driving right past Bell Station. And there's this enormous, so these are like soft golden California hills, just as you imagine them, with these kind of really beautiful oak trees on them. And then all of a sudden, out of these hills is this amazing sort of granite rock. And with sort of the sunset light on it, looks kind of like a gem. But we didn't see it for more than like 30 seconds. And like I was driving, so I couldn't really look at it. But I imagine that if you're riding a horse over this pass, you become very familiar with those things as you go. And you kind of get to appreciate them.
Driving all day up the sand, walking. Turn west again.
turn west again, up through Pacheco.
At the same time, we're pretty lucky. It's terribly convenient to have a car. We figured that we can cover about 6 times as much ground in 1 day than the Buffalo Soldiers could have in the same time.
But the difference between riding a horse and driving a car is more than just a matter of speed. It's a matter of mentality. Justine and I had this aching feeling that we were missing out by going so fast. Missing out on something that we never had. Something we couldn't even find a word for.
The stars are coming out. Or the stars are always there, but we're able to see them.
In Los Banos, our recorder ran out of battery, and we couldn't log anything for the rest of the day. For the record, we passed through Dos Palos, Fireball, Madera, Raymond, Crooks Ranch, and Wawona. These are all the places where we think the Buffalo Soldiers camped on their way to Yosemite. When we stopped at each place, we imagined what it would have been like to camp there 100 years ago. Sometimes it looked like it would have been pretty nice. Sometimes it was dry, hot, flat, pretty miserable.
We arrived in Yosemite Valley in the late afternoon, fatigued. But it was a good kind of fatigue. The kind of fatigue that comes after a whole day out on the road. Yosemite in the early fall is amazing. The maples are yellow, and the road that winds along the river is like a tunnel of gold. At that point, we checked in at the Rangers Club. Our duties seemed less important than enjoying the park and the pure mountain air. The further we got along the trail, the more at ease we became. We took the hybrid shuttle to Curry Village for a microbrew.
So I was just commenting to myself that we hadn't talked about the Buffalo Soldiers all day, even just between the two of us.
But there are these deeper things that are at play, I think, that are happening when we're following this trail. Like, even the emotions we feel, like, we'd enter a certain stretch of land and be like, oh, this must have been a hard day. Oh, man, it's so dusty. There's no scenery, you know. Like, ooh, you know, we felt for them, you know, even if we didn't talk about them in a very, you know, cold and distinctly historical approach, I think we felt a certain kinship.
The next morning, we drove back towards the historic Army headquarters at Wawona. But the road to Glacier Point forks off along the way, so we turned left and started the climb to the hills above the valley where we'd stayed the night before. We went there because it's one of the most well-known, quintessential spots in the park.
For anybody who's never been to Yosemite, this is where a lot of the sort of famous Yosemite photographs have been taken. There's this kind of rock that juts out over a cliff.
John Muir pretty much summed it up when he said, Yosemite Park is a place of rest, a refuge from the roar and dust and weary, nervous, wasting work of the lowlands, in which one gains the advantages of both solitude and society.
The view of Half Dome was somehow calming. Not to say that I don't feel anxiety in nature. One aspect of the sublime is awe, but the other is terror. Regardless, the landscape is so vast that you don't know if you're amazed or if you're afraid. But you're changed. Shelton Johnson is a park ranger at Yosemite. He said something similar.
And this is not just philosophical mumbo-jumbo. Anyone that's ever been to Yosemite for any length of time knows of the power of this place to change the way that you look at the world.
In a way, though, the big box of the lowlands and the big rocks of the mountains are two parts of the same big American whole. The shopping mall and the untouched tracts of wilderness land, both are central tenets of American culture. But the two environments feel so different, It creates this strange disjunction in the way we understand the very land we live on.
When the Buffalo Soldiers were in Yosemite, they saw essentially the same landscape we were seeing. There was a certain comfort in knowing that nothing has really changed here in a while. The beauty of nature is more than just spiritually uplifting. It links us also with our cultural heritage.
In 1903, John Muir and President Theodore Roosevelt met in Yosemite. There's this famous photograph of them, taken from Glacier Point. Roosevelt is short, round, and proud. He looks right at the camera. Muir is tall, wispy, and has an air of a mystic. He gazes off towards the horizon.
Roosevelt was a president of the Progressive Era, when conservation was on the top of the national agenda. Back then, there was a debate about setting aside land for future generations. Some, like Roosevelt, wanted to use some of the frontier for natural resources and set aside some as wilderness. Others, like Muir, saw nature not as a pile of potential resources, but as a powerful, spiritually uplifting force, and they sought to protect it. This famous meeting of the minds sparked the beginning of 20th century civic environmentalism.
The early conservation movement was not just made up of Muir's and Roosevelt's. Muir had the philosophy and Roosevelt had the political power. But when it came down to it, who did the dirty work?
When Roosevelt met Muir in 1903 in that kind of famous meeting of the minds, you'll see that photo of them here at Glacier Point. One thing that you don't really hear about is that the Buffalo Soldiers that year, 1903, were the ones, in Yosemite protecting the park. They were the ones escorting him. They don't appear in any photographs from that event because it was more important that Roosevelt was photographed with VIPs and maybe the more glamorous naturalists than the, you know, the soldiers. But they were here.
Most people are surprised to hear the history of the army in the parks. When we think of soldiers, we think of combat. But the early 1900s were a different era, and the army was a different army.
My name is Shelton Johnson, and I'm a park ranger in the Division of Interpretation and Education here in Yosemite Valley, right here in Yosemite National Park. Well, one thing I think is important to keep in mind is that people today have a completely different perception of the military and the role of the military. It was a different era. You know, it was a whole different military in those days over 100 years ago. I mean, West Point was established by Thomas Jefferson for the whole purpose of nation building. I mean, he wanted to build a cadre of engineers to help build the country. And so, you know, the latter half of the 19th century, West Point actually had the greatest school, if not the only, but the greatest school of engineering in the United States. It was better than Harvard. It was better than Yale. I mean, it was the school to go to if you wanted to be an engineer. And so a West Point officer not only was skilled in military science, a West Point officer also would have been skilled in geology and botany and would have known about soils and would have known about other things that necessarily would have tied into the whole idea of building a road or a community, a town, in what had once been wilderness or just the frontier. So it made perfect sense to have soldiers brought to Yellowstone and Sequoia and Yosemite because that's what they did. That's what they were used to doing. That's what they were trained to do, you know, build infrastructure.
Wawona was our primary Buffalo Soldier destination in Yosemite. This little spot along the Merced River was the first Army headquarters of the park. Back then, it was called Camp A.E. Wood, and Wood was the first military superintendent in 1891. But today, there's no sign of the headquarters. Instead, it's a loop of the Wawona campground. But across the river, we were hoping to find the most significant Buffalo Soldier contribution to Yosemite. We were hoping that it might still exist.
It's an arboretum. It's an arboretum that was built on the South Fork of the Merced, down near in the Wawona area, and is considered to be the first museum in the national park system. It's not just specific and important to Yosemite, but it actually is important in the whole scope of the national park system.
We think we might have found the spot where the arboretum was, but it's really hard to tell. And we're looking for signs of old trail work or, you know, any signs of kind of landscaping. But what we found was a very rocky but beautiful hill and a very flat spot. Not a very flat spot, but a more flat spot with more soil that really shows no signs of ever having been manicured. It's an ideal place to build a garden, really.
Yes, it encourages quiet contemplation of botanical life.
We didn't really find anything.
I was kind of disappointed. I really expected to see something, an old sign or a belt buckle, anything.
But by then, this was becoming the story of our trip. And we started to accept that we probably wouldn't find many tangible traces of the Buffalo Soldiers and their time in the parks. It seemed even more important that we continue to trace their steps.
And with that, we were on our way to Sequoia to find out where the other half of the Buffalo Soldiers had gone after they split at Madera. We were also going to find out more about Charles Young, captain of the 9th Cavalry and superintendent of the park in 1903.
Okay, so we're just leaving Raymond, California. We just got cold drinks, bottled water at, the Frontier Inn. It looks like some sort of general store.
We are back in Madera.
Well, it's 5:03 p.m. on Sunday, and we are in Fresno, population 481,035.
Well, we made it to this little town.
After 10 hours driving on small country roads, we arrived that night in Sequoia National Park.
As its name suggests, there are a lot of giant sequoias in Sequoia National Park. The giant sequoia, it turns out, was widespread in the age of dinosaurs. But now only a few pockets of this tree remain, tucked into special microclimates high in the California Sierra. Something about their thick trunks and heavy limbs, they look like the ancestors of a more evolved and elegant tree. They do have an uncanny dinosaur quality about them.
So we're standing in front of the Colonel Young tree. It kind of looks to me like a big elephant foot or something. But they're really big around, and they're really chunky. They don't have branches for about 40 or 50 feet.
I'm Ward Eldridge. I'm the museum curator for Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. And yeah, the Charles Young tree was a tree named for Charles Young was proposed in 1903 when Young was acting superintendent here at the end of his season. The idea was broached by local citizens that a tree should be named for him, and he felt his career was too fresh. He had not accomplished enough yet.
Charles Young accomplished more in one summer than the officers before him had done in 3 years. Building the first road into Giant Forest was so important that the park continues to recognize this accomplishment today. Just finishing the road into Giant Forest was a big deal. The white crew building the road worked under the charge of an African-American officer. So this road was a diplomatic feat, to put it mildly.
As one of three African Americans who had then graduated from West Point, Young had to overcome many a hardship. He later said that the worst he could wish for his enemy would be to make him a black man and send him to West Point.
Because keep in mind, you know, with the racial attitudes as they existed at the time, a lot of Euro-American soldiers would not have been comfortable seeing an African-American captain and then major and then, you know, then colonel. They would not have been happy about that. And so it would have been a very, very challenging time. I mean, it sounds simple. You see this man walking up toward you, and he has captain's bars. He has the insignia indicating that he's a colonel. And if you're a private, and you're from Alabama or Georgia or Mississippi, somewhere south of the Mason-Dixon, you're still supposed to salute. That is an officer. And I wonder, and I think I've actually read that there probably were instances where there was a reluctant salute, a grudging, you know, salute, because they felt they had to, but they didn't really want to. And you can pick up on that. You can pick up when someone really respects you and someone is feeling forced into some measure of respect. And I think that the accumulation of all of that is very difficult. It has an erosive and a corrosive effect on one's sense of self-worth. It's just how race operates in our society. I think that sometimes it's not the big things, like the Klan riding up to your house and setting fire to a cross. Yes, the big things are very bad. Don't get me wrong. But I think that a lot of what is corrosive to one's character and sense of worth are all the little things, all the little slights. And these little slights add up, and they have this cumulative impact. And the fact that Charles Young went through his professional life and he still maintained that sense of bearing and dignity, and that this is not going to touch me. I know who I am. I know what I can do, and I'm going to do it. And I think it's very remarkable, and we just don't give enough credit to just how difficult a time it was, you know, in that time period in which he was moving through the ranks of the military to achieve what he achieved. It was just a remarkable thing that he did, and he just seemed to rise above that, and I think that's to be applauded. After closing your eyes to me. So, of course, this is taking place in California. I sometimes wonder if you had taken Yosemite and Sequoia and put them in Alabama in the exact same time period, if it could have even worked, you know? But a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was California. It wasn't Mississippi. You know, Mississippi does not house Yosemite. Alabama does not house Yosemite. You know, Louisiana is not the housing for Yosemite. California, you know, was that housing, that cultural context. Race definitely was a potent negative force in California as well. But it had nothing on the South, because that was the battleground. That was the hundreds of years of slavery. So that leaves a scar, and it leaves an echo. It leaves resonance behind, and I think we're still living with that resonance from those 400 years of slavery.
Young proposed instead to name a tree for somebody else, somebody more accomplished. In his words, that great and good American, Booker T. Washington. So, in 1903, they instead named a tree for Booker T. Washington. It was there that we found the only remaining artifact of the Buffalo Soldiers on our entire trip. It was a small nail. It stuck in the bark of this giant sequoia. This is the only thing that links us to the Buffalo Soldiers. A nail.
We are back in front of the Booker T. Washington tree, here to see the nail. Do you see it, Bonnie?
No.
Here, now we're approaching the tree. So if you get up close enough and look up, you can see this one kind of rusty nail just sticking out of the tree. And that's really the only physical evidence of the Buffalo Soldiers here. It's the thing that makes this like more than just a natural landscape, but a distinctly cultural one. She can't even take a picture of it. It held the sign that originally said Booker T. Washington tree.
In 101 years after Young's superintendency, the park made good on its promise to name a tree after him. Officially, the park doesn't name trees anymore. Otherwise, we might end up with a Ronald Reagan tree, a Bill Clinton tree, who knows what kind of tree. It was the first tree to be named in over 60 years, which was a bold move for the parks. I think I understand why they went out of their way to name a tree for Charles Young. After all we'd been through to uncover the history of the Buffalo Soldiers, all we'd found was a nail. Given the general lack of newspaper articles and army records about their time in the parks, it seems important that we go out of our way to tell this story and give people something more meaningful to appreciate.
The national parks and the idea of national parks is as much a cultural relic of our society as it is nature. It's not just natural, it is cultural. Every national park, no matter how wild it is. If it's in Alaska, if it's in the West, it doesn't matter. All of these parks are also have as great a value as a cultural entity as they do a natural entity. And we tend to forget that. We just tend to see it as, well, it's nature, it's wild, it's wilderness, and it's mountains and rivers and forests, but it's also an idea.
When we set out on our road trip, I expected to see the same scenery that I had already seen before. To some extent, I did. The vistas in the parks are as spectacular as ever. The nail is still in the tree. But on this trip, I realized that every landscape is layered with years and years of history. And most of the time, we look without really seeing. Underneath the pavement is an old wagon road. Underneath the big box is an old army campsite. And over on the other side of the river is an overgrown arboretum. Hiding in that landscape are stories of Charles Young and the Buffalo Soldiers, some of our most visionary and humble stewards of the West. And in retracing the steps of the Buffalo Soldiers, maybe we came close to capturing their spirit.
After Young left Sequoia, he wrote that he came to Sequoia with a heart full of bitterness and left it a different man with a better outlook. And I bet that 100 years ago, the Buffalo Soldiers felt similar to the way I feel in those trees today. At rest, in awe, humbled. And we share that across space, time, culture, race, class, and all those other illusions that we sometimes let between us. The next morning, we packed the truck and started to head home. On the trip back to San Francisco, we didn't talk very much. I kept imagining that we were riding along the old road, going slow, taking our sweet autumn time.